Hello. I hope there's somebody on the other side. It's me, João Vitória, here for another session of a Journey to the Web Summit. Today about brand and consumer psychology. So welcome everybody. Let me just start off with a quick public service announcement, if I can get my computer to cooperate. What is going on? There you go. So, any questions, any feedback, anything you want to tell me during this session, please tweet with this hashtag MicrosoftJWS. Always a pleasure to be here at Microsoft Portugal, where I'm right now with the local DX team. Thank you for another invite. For one of your Ativar Portugal events, that it's big initiative they have for startups here. I think they do fantastic work. It's always a pleasure. And personally, I really identify with a lot of the values of this platform. And thank you that are listening to this right now for joining in. So quickly, this is me not speaking at TED, contrary to popular belief. So my name is João Vitória, which I know is a mouthful and kind of strange because my accent does not sound Portuguese. So I'm the founder and creative director at Feng. So Feng is a creative studio. We're not an agency, not a digital marketing company, not selling chimichangas. So sorry to all the Deadpool fans out there. Basically, we're a creative studio that helps brands, other agencies, startups connect with audiences. We're trying to look at things differently, and our inspiration comes from this Chinese proverb that I find that maybe it's the driver behind a lot of startups today, because things have really changed, and a lot of businesses and new ideas are coming up because culture changed, people changed, and some industries keep building those walls, and that's fine, obviously. Some fail when they build those walls. And what I feel that, just like us, startups are trying to build better windmills and trying to work upon what is the culture today of the audience. And I think there's huge opportunity out there right now. You see a lot of good stuff coming out every day, a lot of people doing different things. And one the big change that I think that in the way the wind is blowing, to take that metaphor a little bit further, is that audiences nowadays, they're in charge of what's relevant, of what matters, and to a certain extent, what will be successful. So right now, congratulations to humankind. We have an 8-second attention span, so goldfish are beating us now on attention span also. Another interesting thing is that we used to be huge multitaskers. And because of this is my view, obviously, but because of the technological and information revolution that we've been through in the past few years, we are now also multi-screen and multi-context all the time, which obviously brings its own set of challenges to what we're doing. And sorry about the mouse. Can you see this? No, you can't. Oh, yes, you can. Yes, I'm getting a nod that yes, you can. Trying to control my presentation, it's not going well, but I'll wing it. And the last point about what's changing with the audience is a lot of stuff is going on in our subconscious all the time. We're filtering out a huge amount of information that passes us by every single day. So maybe it's a good time, I think, to look at how people think. So right now, so that's the status quo of the audience, and the way I see it, and I think a lot of people are seeing it actually nowadays, is just roll with it. The audience will always decide what's relevant. So I think that we have to have our ear to the ground and really have people in the demographic that we're reaching out to and really understand why culture is changing. So I think one of the big examples is the music industry, when the Napster came out and everybody went berserk over that, because my personal perception is that the music industry thought these people do not want to pay for music, they want to steal our music, and I don't think that was the issue, because if you look at the music industry today, people are paying money for the actual music and buying subscriptions and buying music by the song. What I think is, and this is, again, my personal perception, people were tired of the CD model. People were tired for $20 or $30 for a bit of plastic that had little value. And I think people were not connecting with a collection of songs that two were hits, if you're lucky, eight were subpar, and you have to buy them all. And if you see it today, music is relevant as a business again. Culturally, obviously, it's always been relevant. I think it's one of the big drivers of culture. But they went through a hard time because I think they were fighting it. I think some other industries took that as a lesson. I think television and the movie industries really understood what went on. And I think they're riding the wave in a much smarter way because the opportunities are just different. And if you look at video content today, in terms of the big productions, it's funny that you see like the big TV awards and you see companies like Netflix and HBO, which is just cable, and Amazon, which sells stuff online, they're getting the Emmy nominations. So they understand what people want, what audiences want. Obviously, they don't have as much regulation as TV stations, but they learn from lessons from other industries and they're riding the wave. But I digress. So back to what I'm supposed to be talking about today. And the first point is a brand. So what is brand? And I've been doing a lot of conferences here at Microsoft Portugal to start. It's about what brand is. And because, well, at least technical startups that have apps and different kinds of services, it's people come from technical backgrounds and not from communication backgrounds, and they've been reacting well to this. So this is my first subject, is what does brand do for you? What is a brand? And I'll start by deconstructing one of the biggest brands out there, which is Coca-Cola. I think it's a brand that is beyond destruction at this point. I think that the CEO of Coca-Cola could punt a baby over the goal line and it would be fine, because there is so much history to Coca-Cola and so many people connect to the brand and they sponsor so many things that they're just there and they're not going to go away. Although they know this, but they're really smart about the business in my opinion. They know that the value that they have is the brand per se. I think they really understood early on that culture was changing. If you go back to a video they launched in 2011 called Coca-Cola 2020, you see a lot of stuff that is going on today with a lot of brands in terms of digital communication and how to connect to your audiences. So if you're curious about that, check that out. It's called Coca-Cola 2020. You can find it very easily on YouTube. So one challenge I always present when I'm talking about brand is, let's say you split Coca-Cola in two, and one person gets just the logo and the rights to the name. The other person, or the other group of individuals, will get the factories, the distribution, the secret formula, if you want. And in this scenario, the question is always, which would you take? And I don't think there's a right or wrong answer, but my point of view is that I'd go with the brand and the logo any day of the week, twice on weekends. Because I think that brand is a strong asset, if not the strongest asset you can have in a business. Because brand makes it easier for people to know that it's you, it's Coca-Cola that's talking to you right now. It makes you recognizable. And over time, brand will make you feel something. And if you get the tone right and you're consistent in your communication, as soon as you start talking, people just know it's you. So, your brand. What is your brand? And I know that a lot of people put a lot of effort into building a brand, and they would really love their brand to be all the things that they've listed in the brand book. And it just doesn't happen like that. It never did. The thing is that now with social media and the quick news cycles and interest cycles you have in the world due to technology, your brand is now, it's more perceivable that the brand is not what you say it is, but it's kind of the audience's interpretation of what you're seeing, what you're saying, as a brand, saying and doing. And so this presents a challenge because you may want to anchor your brand in a certain kind of emotion or a certain kind of territory, and maybe people are not reacting to that. So you have obviously a couple of choices. First, well, if the wind is not blowing you the way you wanted, what are you going to do? You cannot control the weather, that is for sure. But you can't always do what people want you to do, because you have to be a firm believer in your message. But you have to be smart about it, and if it's not working, you should adjust. But moving along, this might seem a little bit obvious, but let's break down what builds a brand by some components. And Nike is another great example of great branding. And two obvious things are always the name and the logo. So the name Nike, it comes from the Greek goddess of victory, if I'm not mistaken. And huge brand. And they have their logo, which is highly recognizable. The logo is not just a swoosh, although they sign a lot of times with just the swoosh and use it very creatively in their communication. The font they're using with their name is also part of the logo. And that's part of the identity of the company. Because if you see a lot of, well, at least I see this a lot in basketball because that's something I follow, they will do a lot of apparel that will have an NBA basketball player's name with the Nike type that they use. And it's immediately recognizable. But one of my favorite components of any brand is the signature. And Nike has a powerful signature. I know this may seem redundant, but it's just words, but it's so powerful. When you hear or read "just do it," you know that Nike is talking to you. And there's a double entendre here that I think that is very interesting, because they're making it about you and not you as a consumer, and not about their products. They position themselves as an enabler for you to be more active. And yes, you can do sports and lead a healthier life and all those good stuff, those good things. But it's also about them. They chose that territory, and slowly they understood what people were reacting to, and they built upon what people were reacting to, because Nike is really associated with running, for instance, but they did not force the running phenomenon. Yes, they had the Nike Plus, and a lot of people jumped on that, but it happened, and they said, this is too good an opportunity not to position our brand for the every man and the every woman that just wants to put on a pair of sneakers, some shorts, a t-shirt, and just do it. So I think that was really, really smart, and they stick to it. They really stick to their brand book and the way they talk, because I think this is of great importance, because brands, just like people, they're not really interesting if they don't have a personality. And the identity of a brand is the brand's personality. And personality is not just what it's about you, it's what things are you in the market for. And always, any single time I'm talking about values, territory, and brand personality, I always go back to this this quote by Bill Birnbach, the legendary advertiser and founder of the world famous DDB agency. Stand for something. This is just great. It seems simple, but when you look at some of his work back in the 60s that kind of changed the landscape of brand communication. And if you look at it today, successful brands stand for something. So Nike, for instance, as I was talking about before, they stand for empowering you, the consumer, to be an athlete, to be an aspiring athlete, to lead a healthier life. So Bill Birnbach, back in the 60s, he got famous for all these Volkswagen ads that he ran back in the day. And Volkswagen, with this piece of advertising, was really standing for something. So Lemon, in American English at least, is not the best name you can call a car. But if you read the long copy that's below, it will say, well, this car missed the boat because the chrome strip on the glove compartment just was not up to par with what the inspector at the Volkswagen factory thought was the standard of quality of a Volkswagen. And then they go on and on, rant about how more than 3,000 men and women at Volkswagen are bringing you the best cars. So this car that looks like a perfectly good car, that's an icon of design, which, by the way, is just unbelievable that in the 60s, I don't know, 15 years removed from Second World War, you get a German car selling in the U.S. and being successful. Why? Because the brand stood for something. And when you stand for something and you're consistent about it, I think the audience will react and they will flock to your brand. So, oh, Mariana Rich has a question. Juan Vidalia, that's me. What are the top mistakes you see startups making when building their brands? Okay, I think that's an interesting question. I don't have like a top three of mistakes or a top whatever of mistakes, but what this is my personal perception. Obviously, I'm very limited to the group of startups I've been exposed to in terms of working together. And that leads me to what actually is coming up next is what builds brand. And I think one of the maybe the top mistakes is not realizing that everything you say and do influences your brand. That's when you're talking, when you open your mouth, even in your personal lives, if you bomb with a joke or if you're really funny, that affects your personal brand. So a service, a product, when they communicate, being advertising or whatever you do, below the line, digital marketing, everything you do and say will build your brand in a certain direction, okay? I know that it seems like a lot, and it creates like this kind of infinite loop that what you say will make a perception on the side of the audience, and you have to keep your ear to the ground and really monitor what's going on. And the big challenge is, when will you adjust? Like I was saying before, when will you adjust to reactions, or will you hold steady and be true to yourself and say, okay, you may be not enjoying this as much as the other stuff I say, but this is what we stand for and we're really true about ourselves. And it all goes back to personality. If you have an inconsistent personality, I think people will be kind of suspicious of you and not really connect to you. So yeah, I hope that addressed at least one of the issues. It's very broad, but I think that will help. Following up on that, a lot of people ask, where should I build my brand? And the answer to that is also very broad, which is everywhere. And obviously, I'm being very liberal about the use of the word everywhere. But if there's somebody out there that matters to you, you have to reach out. Of course, you're not going to get to everybody and everything and to everywhere. You have to prioritize, but you have to get to as many media outlets as you can. And if this is not enough to get you pumped, because, you're just hearing my voice, which is only like one third of communication or less, see a couple of videos online on YouTube by Gary Vaynerchuk from VaynerMedia. He's an author of several very interesting books about brand communication, very specific on social media. He will jump and scream and curse, and you will get pumped about building your brand and being relentless about that pursuit. And I guarantee you will never forgive yourself when you're watching Game of Thrones and you're not building your brand. But that's my take on it. I really think there's value in Gary's words. And especially if social is important to you, please follow him online. He has a ton of great advice. So that said, what is a brand? What are the components or some of the components of the brand? You have to look at how brands are behaving today, because like I was saying in the beginning, times really change, the wind is blowing in a different direction, and you have to understand, how do I do it today? And the interesting thing, and maybe I'm gonna take a little while on this point, is debranding, I think, is one of the biggest trends right now. Now, debranding is not doing all the things I've been raving about for the past 15 minutes or so. You have to do all that stuff. But the thing is that for a long time, I think that a lot of people thought that a good marketing, good positioning of your product or your service, and great advertising would do it for you. Well, maybe that worked for a while. The thing is that consumers now have a very huge voice, and everybody is a brand advocate or somebody that cannot help your brand. So if you don't have a great product, you can do all the branding and all the marketing and all the advertising you want, because value is king right now. And I don't think that things are that much about price anymore. Well, just look at how much you're paying for a smartphone, which is basically a super advanced computer that's in your pocket. We're paying ridiculous amounts of money, and companies, no offense to all these companies, but they're making huge profit on this because it's all about the value. So you'll be paying 700, 800, 900 euro for top shelf phone because the value is there. It's, yes, the hype machine of the marketing and the advertising helps, but if there was no value, people would not be paying these ridiculous prices for these equipments. So focusing on the product and not just focusing on your brand, I think is the big trend. And I think that a lot of startups are successful because they really focus on product, because it's people that are creatively driven, I dare to say, to build something new and to challenge whoever is right now in the market, and they think they can do it better or give out more value. Obviously, you still should have a brand. You should work on that. You should have a good brand identity and be consistent and do all that, but evolve over time. And the funny thing is that a lot of the current businesses, or the businesses that have been along for a long time, or kind of debranding, or, well, I think debranding is a too strong a term. I think they're making their communication more, they're making the communication leaner. Okay, and one great example is MasterCard. They just unleashed their new logo upon the world, and I thought it was a very, very smart move. I'm not gonna go into the aesthetics of it, and I just thought it was a good move, because after a ton of time, since the dawn of credit cards, that they've had one form or another of this logo. MasterCard goes from this over to this leaner logo. And I think just being leaner sends out a message, because you look at this, and in the back of your mind, you're thinking about it. Even if your conscious thought is not thinking about it, you understand that, or you process that MasterCard is trying to keep up with the current times. And that that design that they were using before was just outdated, and they had to do something about it. And the interesting thing about this is it will not take them as much time from jumping from the previous logo to this logo than they will take over to this that we're seeing right now, which is just two circles, one red, one yellow, or mustard, whatever color you think it is. And their intersection is orange. And you know it's MasterCard. Even without a signature at the end, or even without their name. And why this has happened, and starting to follow along to the consumer psychology part of this presentation, salience and accessibility are the two things that will make you connect to the new MasterCard logo, even if there's not a signature. Okay? So their brand association is, I think, almost indestructible. Why not? So, salience and accessibility, how does this work? So the salience comes from being one of the most successful, okay? And the accessibility comes from being constantly reminded that they exist, even if you don't have a MasterCard in your wallet. But the high frequency of communication makes the brand accessible in your memory. And before I tread down this path too far, let me just dial it back a notch and talk about one of the big acronyms in the marketing industry, which is ADA, the classic conversion funnel. Advertising and marketing use this, and probably you're using or this or another version of the funnel with at least four steps, maybe one more. And so this is all about getting people's attention, getting them interested, trying to get them to desire our product, our service, and then having them take action upon said desire. So salience and accessibility are the two principles that guide our memory. So if we stand out and we keep communicating things will stick to our memory. There's a big effort to get into people's memories. So when you get there, try not to jump off or fall off their memory. And I think that comes from consistency, being true to your identity and making it easy for people to remember it's you that's talking about. And moving along with memory, I think that memory is, from a psychology standpoint, or from my interpretation of what I've learned, I'm not a psychologist, obviously, memory is like a file system, maybe, if that's something you can relate to. It's that you don't have everything that's in your memory immediately accessible, but when you're in the situation that you have to remember something, the folder will open up and the file that has the script of how to get your hair cut will come to your consciousness. So, one interesting study that I've found, this comes from the good folks at the Carroll School of Management from Boston College. They did this study that they got, from what I remember, non-gamers to play Forza 2. Everybody had the same car. Everybody had a different brand in their car. And the interesting thing was that recurrently, the same brand was winning the races. Okay, this gets really interesting when you realize that the brand that was winning not all, but maybe most of the races was Red Bull. People that were driving the Red Bull car were more aggressive, more reckless, and basically not activating their memory about how to be a civilized person driving a car. Why? Because there's a context, and the memory is highly affected by context. So if you think that brand does not have a powerful influence on how we behave, I'll give the short reference of everything I'm basing this upon in the end of the deck. But read through this paper. It is absolutely fascinating how the whole Red Bull gives you wings, positioning, and signature really influences people to act differently. So moving along from memory, when the attention or the awareness phase, however you want to call it, obviously attention is a big issue. And like I was saying in the beginning, we're being outperformed by goldfish by now. And this happens, I think this is a reflex of society and information in general now. There's so much of it that our attention now is highly automatic and selective. And we're only processing on a conscious level around 1/5 of what's going on. So if you don't work that 8-second window that you have in everybody that you're impacting, you're gone and people are going to forget about you. And basically you're spending time and money not connecting with people. So being relevant is really, really, really important. But last but not least, perception. That performs a lot in how our attention works, because perception is ran by our own goals and motivation, but it can be easily influenced. Let me just show you a quick example, and this is something that I thought about for a long time, and only I'd say recently, 4 or 5 years ago, that I get some kind of scientific insight on why this happened. When Google showed up, the dominant force on the internet was Yahoo. And I think that the behavior was already shifting at that time from people wanting a directory towards people wanting a good search engine. But I don't think that was really evident at the time. And the interesting thing that Google, it was obviously not an overnight success, and it was not like number one overnight, but it was really fast. And for a long time, I thought that it was geek and tech communities telling the non-technical folk that, listen, Google is like way better than Yahoo in terms of search. And what you really want is search. You don't need the directory and all that. And I thought that people were flocking to Google because of that, because this is like pre-smartphone revolution. And I think that non-technical folk had no way to be sure that Google search was better before using it like 100 times and getting consistently better results. So I thought that was the reason for a very, very long time. But fortunately, I stumbled upon a paper called the Gold Dilution Principle, which is really interesting. And I'm not going to go too deep into that. You can go into that later if this if it does it for you and if you think it's relevant or interesting. Basically, if you want something and there are two offers of that same something you want, if one company is offering just what you want and the other company is offering what you want and a million other things, regardless of how many they are, the findings of the study is that people will go towards the company that is offering only what they want. Because, and I can't get too technical about this because, again, not a psychologist, but the findings is that people will categorize in a higher shelf the companies that is just offering what you want. Because if it was not superior to the competition, why the hell would they only be doing that on their homepage? Just having a logo, a combo box, and a search button. It would be ridiculous, right? So people subconsciously say, well, if you're doing just this one thing, you must be the best at it. And well, go into that if it's interesting to you. But if you're rolling out an app or service and you have a ton of features that you want to put out there, I'd strongly recommend that you take a look at this because it has a lot of value there to dial it down a notch and not just crank out feature after feature after feature, because it may be hurting you in the end if you're positioning yourself as a competitor or there's somebody that has a similar service to you. Moving along. So phase two, after awareness comes the interest phase, and this is one of the most interesting phases for me because this is a kind of recent discovery for me, maybe 3 years back. I got a lot of insight of how the thought process happens in people's mind. And the reigning theory up to the time of Thinking Fast is Slow by Daniel Kahneman was published is that left brain, right brain, the more creative, the more analytical and all that. And Daniel Kahneman, well, I think he's right. And the Nobel Prize Committee thought he was right because he's the first psychologist to ever win the Nobel Prize. And he won that in economics. So that's a big deal. People think in an automatic way and a controlled way. And this kind of makes sense because when you're in autopilot, what he calls system one, by the way, calls this system one and system two, system one being the automatic, we have a lot of experience. We have our gut feeling. We have our goals and motivations. And we're only processing 20% because the other 80% is being discarded, by autopilot, by system one. Because if something, let's say it's yellow, I hate the color yellow, I'm not even going to look at that. If some kind of industry uses over and over a certain kind of color in their logo, in their communication, let's say blue, and if you're trying to compete with them and you use pink, and people have pink in their minds associated with frozen yogurts opposed to burgers and fries, that's what you're trying to sell, people automatically will say, well, this is pink. This must be frozen yogurt or ice cream, and I'm looking for burgers, so I'm at the food court. I'm hungry. I want ice cream as a meal, as you should not. I think that's a good dietary option. Automatic is just so, so powerful. And if you don't understand that, in that awareness phase, in those 8 seconds, and if you don't really work in and get people's interest, they will not go over to control thought, where they go into consideration and they really try to connect and understand what you're saying. Well, understand first, obviously, and if they like it, they will connect to you, okay? But more on that a little bit later. So after interest, obviously, there's the desire phase, and desire is real interesting because here's where, in my point of view, a lot of businesses, brands, or whatever are failing because they don't understand the difference between, in terms of psychology, what is an attitude and what is a behavior, okay? So the attitude is how I feel about something, and behavior is how I act upon that attitude. The funny thing is that sometimes our behaviors will contradict our attitude. And from my understanding, this is mainly in a European audience, so I think that European football, I was going to say soccer, sorry, European football is a great example of this. Let's say that your club scores the goal into the final of the Champions League, you're going to celebrate that goal like there's no tomorrow, obviously, because that's your attitude. But behavior can contradict that attitude, and it depends on context. Okay, so let's say that you're a Real Madrid fan, let's say, and they just scored on Liverpool, or let's say Liverpool, and it's the cup final. You will celebrate, you will just go nuts, because that's like the huge competition in Europe. But if the final was at Liverpool Stadium, your behavior will not be in line with your attitude, because the context is different. Because I'm surrounded by all these Liverpool fans. Sorry, Liverpool is just random. Not trying to insult anybody, obviously. But it's not the same thing. You're not at Vicente Calderon, which is the Real Madrid stadium. You're not at your home court. So your behavior is going to be a little different from your attitude. So behavior is more, let's say, when we're talking about the interest phase, more aligned with system one. It's very automatic. Attitude is more system two. It's more controlled. It's your belief. It's part of your belief system. Okay? I'll wrap this up and tie this up. I don't know if this is a lot to take in, but I'm just going over the phases, and later on we'll take a look at the whole shebang. So the funny thing is that if you communicate right, you can persuade people. You can change or influence their attitude. And it's stronger if you try to influence or persuade them to change an attitude than a behavior. Because let's say that you don't like credit card companies because your belief system, your attitude says that they're evil and you want nothing to do with those people. And if your communication is based upon behavior and say, you should have a credit card, the outcome, I think, is going to be, no, I don't. Why should I want a credit card? Because my attitude is not aligned with your communication. You're saying, buy now. I'm like, no, I'm not buying anything of that. I don't like it. I don't relate to that. Or I'm just not aware that credit cards were relevant anymore because I use PayPal. Okay? So persuasion, always stronger when you're trying to, in the desire phase, work upon people's attitudes. Moving along to the last phase of the funnel, action. And this is highly influenced by the previous three stages, so attention, interest, and desire. In the action phase, three things can happen. Well, first of all, is nothing changes, which is kind of frustrating because you spend all this time and effort and money in trying to get people to change about a certain brand or a certain perception. Nothing happens, you're failing. Not good. Another thing that can happen is a new attitude is formed. People, you are not in their thought spectrum, and suddenly you're anchored in their memory or in their radar, which is interesting. So if that space is not occupied, at least now you're in the radar. Now, the most interesting outcome, in my opinion, is when you modify an attitude. Because there are a lot of industries that are failing because people's attitude toward those industries are not as favorable as they used to. Let's say, talking about startups, let's say Airbnb. Essentially, if you look at it, in the end, people are buying a place where to sleep. The thing is, the attitude towards hotels was, you're selling, or you're putting into the price a lot of stuff that I don't value, because, okay, I don't need a continental breakfast, because I want to just get on the go. I'll go to the supermarket and buy something else, or I'll have breakfast someplace that has a better view than the lounge that is packed with tourists eating croissants. Airbnb came and work upon the attitude of how people were looking at places to stay. Because in the beginning, it's kind of strange. Wait a minute, I'm going to stay at somebody else's house? That is not what I want. But being connected to a social network, and you have your peers, other travelers, evaluating and saying, no, this was great. The guy showed up. He gave me the key. The house was perfect. Everything was clean. He never showed up. Great experience. People have a new attitude towards first staying at other people's houses, and then because the price was right, way below a hotel, a new attitude was formed against their competition, which was hotels. So I think that's a quick and a very demonstrative example of how you can influence people's attitude with your product or your brand communication. So wrapping things up in terms of model and how this works for brands, with your funnel, consider this. Consider that when you're reaching out to people, they have a memory. And there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of baggage that they have to account for before you start thinking that I'm just going to say stuff that matters to me. And maybe they already have something in their memory that contradicts whatever you're saying. Remember that people's attention span is way below what it should be. And perceptions already in place in people's memories. In the interest phase, consider that people are not always looking at your communication like they look at art, that they really stop and try to take in it and understand what's going on. People are mostly in autopilot, so if you don't get them really quickly and you're not relevant and you're not delivering any kind of value to them, they will not get out of automatic thought, they will not go into controlled thought, and your communication will not be as effective as it can. Into desire. This leads us into what is an attitude? What is a behavior? When should I act upon an attitude or a behavior? The great thing right now is that with digital marketing, you can segment your message for people that you have to work on the attitude and people that already have positive attitude towards our brand or our service or whatnot, and work upon the behavior and said, you really love us, so buy now. Here's a new phone. Here's a new can of worms, whatever it is. And consider that. Wrap it up. Action produces outcomes. Those outcomes are highly influenced by these three previous steps. And not a big fan of quotes, but I really like this one, and I kept it down to two in this deck. Today, my personal belief, and I think a lot of the communication industry is realizing this and trying to work upon this, people don't as much buy stuff from brands as they used to. As maybe nowadays, people are using brands. The brand is like an extension of their persona. Because when you buy, let's say, a Porsche, that says stuff about you. I'm not saying it's right or wrong or good or bad, but the car you drive, at least for a certain generation, says stuff about you. Even nowadays, if you're a Mac or a PC guy, it says stuff about you. Depending on the phone you have, it says stuff about you. So the interesting thing is that, tying back to the beginning of this deck, people do not see the things as they are. So brand is not what we want it to be. Because people don't see things as they are. People see things as they are. The person. They have their own set of filters. Going back to the first step of the funnel, they have their own perceptions. They have their own goals. They have their own motivations. So if you try to hammer it too hardly on this is what this is, I think that will work in the opposite direction of what you want, which is getting people on board with your product or service and making that sell, which is getting harder and harder, by the way. So if any of the references interest you, here's a slide that print screen now, if you want to save this. So I didn't reference this, I think, during what I was saying, but if you want to learn more about brand, read any book by Marty Neumeier. I think it's any of his books. It's just, you'll learn a ton. I love them. I read them over and over again. On social media, follow Gary Vaynerchuk on Medium or on YouTube. Guy has really a lot of smart stuff to say, and his attitude and energy are just, they're at 11. That guy is almost on the verge of being out of control, if not out of control. But I find him really inspiring, and you can learn a lot. This guy turned his parents' business, his wine business, into a huge hit. And after that, he created VaynerMedia. It's one of the hottest creative shops in the world. I'd really pay attention. The scientific documents, the one about memory and context, Red Bull gives you wings for better or for worse. Search for that on Google. You'll get right to that. Perception, the dilution model, how those additional goals or more stuff can be clutter instead of working positively towards your brand. Google that, and you'll get that PDF really, really quickly. So, if you want to keep the conversation going, here, once again, this is me not speaking at TED. That's my email with a much friendlier JV that mouthful of my name in Portuguese. Reach out or hit me up on Twitter if you want to. And I think we still have some time left. Not sure. Say hello with this hashtag just to be interesting to find out if you have any questions, if you have any opinions, we still have some time. Or if you want to get on with your day, that's fine too. And if there's no questions, we'll wait for a little while. Thank you so much for joining in. Don't forget to check up on aka.ms/JWS masterclasses for all the other sessions, past and future. And I have Mariana with me from Microsoft Portugal. She's waving and something's going on. Is there any question? No questions. Everybody's getting on with their day, which is perfectly fine. Fortunately, if you're joining in now or if you joined in the middle of the masterclass, the session will be live on channel 9 right now. Twitter will not shut down, I think, so you can ask later and we can keep the conversation going in online on Twitter. Reach out through email, whatever you want, and good luck out there with your startups, and I hope you guys have a good time here in Portugal when you come over for Web Summit in November. See you soon.